right, it looks like we're ready. If the clerk will please announce who's arguing today for Cox v. State.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott Brown to argue for the appellant, Mr. David Carroll to argue for the state.
All right, Mr. Brown.
May it please the court. As I think justices are aware, I'm Scott Brown. I represent Mr. Stephen Cox. This is a case where Mr. Cox was convicted of an aggravated kidnapping with intent to commit sexual abuse of a child and sexual assault, and actually two counts of sexual assault. The first thing I want to talk about just is a correction to my brief. On page 19, where I give a definition of when a kidnapping is without the consent of a child who is 14, 15, or 16. The definition should read that the victim is taken outside of the state. That's the phrase I left out, outside of the state and outside a 120-mile radius from the victim's residence. It's a kind of an interesting lack of consent law, but consent is not the issue in this case. I'm not arguing lack of consent, but that is a correction that I did notice in my brief. A brief recitation of the facts will show that back in 2013, the RC, who was the child, was 14 years old. She lived in Haltom City. She and my client, Mr. Cox, who was a 26-year-old person living in Ohio, began a chat room relationship on a chat service called Kick Messenger. Very quickly after they began Kick messaging back and forth or chatting back and forth in March of 2013, this developed into swapping messages via text. RC provided Mr. Cox her phone number, and then after that, all of their communication occurred via text from cell phone to cell phone. And that's going to become very important. The things that happened before Mr. Cox made his way to Haltom City, and then eventually Mr. Cox and RC traveled by bus to El Paso and then walked across a bridge to Mexico, to Juarez, Mexico. Those are all going to be important facts, exactly how that happened, how they got to where they were going, and RC's participation and planning in this trip to Mexico. But you got to start with the kidnapping statute, which we all think just seems like a pretty simple little statute, okay? So you kidnap someone if you abduct another person, or that seems pretty straightforward. Then there's the definition of abduct, which means to restrain a person with intent to prevent his liberation by secreting or holding him in a place where he's not likely to be found. And the case law tells us that secreting or holding a person in a place where they're not likely to be found, that modifies the intent. That's your mens rea. but then we're left with what is restrain. So we get a definition of restrain. Restrict a person's movement without consent so as to interfere substantially with the person's liberty by moving the person from one place to another. So we have several components of what restraint is, but restricting a person's movement is one element. Without that person's consent, that's separate. Those two things are separate. Restraint then becomes the actus reus, the act that the person is committing. Again, I'm not arguing that this is a without consent issue. My position is that based upon all the facts of this situation, a state did not prove the element of restraint.
Scott, you remember that case? It's a parking lot case where the complainant was on one side of the car or something out in the parking lot, and the defendant wouldn't allow the complainant to get back into the building, and they said the complainant was restrained in the whole world except where she wanted to be. Remember that case? It was a weird one. But
I remember one along those lines. I thought it was at her home. Did they go back to the house?
I thought this was in a parking lot of a bar, but it could have been at the house. I don't know.
If it's the same one, I think they were in a bar and went back to the house.
Okay.
And that's what the court did say. That was a weird one.
But this is a weird case we've got today, too.
I think the interesting thing about that is it points out that all of these fact situations are unique and different. And this one, after looking at, maybe I'm exaggerating, but a lot of cases, 50, 60, 100 cases, trying to find something on point to give you all and say, this is like this. Nothing is like this. Nothing is like this case.
Can there be a separate kidnapping statute when children are involved? Because everything is different when there's a child involved. You've got parental consent. You've got a child can't really consent to anything.
Right. I think the legislature tries to cover that by saying that if the child is under 14, they can't consent. That's just the consent component, though. And then if a child's 14, 15, or 16, they can consent unless they go over 120 miles away and outside the state. But consent's a separate issue. This is
I'm not talking about consent. I'm talking about what you're talking about. And if it's interfering with child custody,
that's a totally...
That's different. Or the other stuff like that. It's hiding the child.
Right.
Is all it takes. Well, do you think that the kidnapping statute needs that provision?
I don't know if it needs that one, but the kidnapping statute, I believe, was originally promulgated in like 1973. And it's been amended through the years and certain things added to it. But I think the last time it was amended was maybe the late 90s, early 2000s. The problem we have now is when the legislature, or when we used to think of what a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old was back 15, 20 years ago, Kick Messenger didn't exist. Text messaging didn't exist. I have a 14-year-old. They're very different. And so in this case, when RC communicates with Mr. Cox, and the testimony was there were 285 text messages back and forth between RC and appellant from April 21st to April 24th. The detective testified this looked like a conversation between the two of them. We know there are 65 text messages between RC and Mr. Cox just on the day that Mr. Cox gets to, comes from Ohio via bus to Haltom City and meets RC outside her school.
But is that even relevant if she can't consent, if consent isn't an issue, and if the only question is restraint, and is it restrained from the parents?
It is relevant because if we wanted to say that when the child can't consent, that's the end of things, then the legislature could just define restraint as without consent if you're under 17. But they don't. They say you still have to restrict their movement by moving the person from one place to another.
There's not even an exception for the dentist. I mean, you take a child to the dentist, you certainly don't have consent. And you're certainly restraining that child. Technically, if you read it literally, you've got a kidnapping every time you take the child to the dentist or to school if the child didn't want to go.
Well, I think that...
So does there need to be a different statute when children are involved?
That's so far beyond me.
Although there is a proof.
But I think your key point is this. Yes, there probably needs to be a discussion, but the problem is we don't want to have statutes. I think that's what the problem we get into. Legislatures see a fact situation and they address it with a specific statute that applies to that fact situation. Like, say, a legislator wants to fix this dentist issue that you're talking about. Well, they draft a statute that's addressed at that, but then the statute can't be applied that way. The state may try to apply it to other situations that the legislature didn't intend, but on its face you could do it. So I think leaving it the way it is and focusing on the fact that consent's one issue and restraint is another issue, And you look at this case, and this is a case where, again, because it's the modern world, we have video. And we have video that shows exactly how RC was behaving when she sat in the Greyhound bus station with Mr. Cox for 2 hours before they got on the bus.
But we have to look at this case in the light most favorable to the verdict.
Yes, we do.
And there was some evidence that she said he had threatened her family. And so can't restraint be a restraint by intimidation? In other words, you don't have physical chains, but you've got the threat of harm. So it's a restraint by threat.
I think the statute is clear that intimidation or force or deception goes again to the consent element. It's defined that it's without consent if the person uses force, deception, or intimidation. But that's separate. That's separate than whether you restrict them and you restrict their movements. So again, this is one of the most complicated fact situations as I started to analyze it, trying to figure out what this statute really means. But if you read it, the plain language of the statute, we have to give effect to everything the legislature put in it. And because they made consent separate, tied consent into force, intimidation, or deception, tied consent into age, but didn't tie the same force, intimidation, or deception into whether you restricted their movement, we have to look at this and just look at the facts as they are. The threat to her family, there was testimony about that. However, there was other testimony from RC where she testified that these threats were made while Mr. Cox was in Ohio via text. She did not communicate those to anybody.
But it really doesn't matter if we're looking at it in light most favorable to the verdict, because you're explaining away, and that's enough to say, I believe on this record, don't you think, to support the verdict. There is testimony that we can't discredit her. The jury decided what to believe and what not
sure.
to believe.
I agree with that, that we do have to look at it in the light most favorable. Certainly that's the standard. But if no rational juror could find restraint or restriction of movements based on all of this evidence, then...
So you think it rises to that level?
I think it rises to that level because it's so complicated and so... There was so much videotaped evidence and there was so much testimony, and my concern is that we will look at this, the jurors would look at this, we as parents or lawyers or justices will look at this and say, well, this is just bad. He's 26 years old. He shouldn't come down here, buy a bus, meet a 14-year-old, and go to Mexico with her. And we have to divorce ourselves of that. And we have to look, or I should say, you have to look, at all the video evidence. Look at all the evidence that was admitted and see that this child was not restricted. She participated in the planning. It's clear from her own testimony she participated. She testified that she told Mr. Cox, I want to run away because my parents are fighting. I want to run away. She further testified that she didn't feel like she was in over her head until she got to El Paso, and she regretted going with Mr. Cox. So again, if we want to look at all her testimony, certainly she said he threatened her family, threatened to hurt them. It's sort of a generic threat. But if you look at all of the testimony, you look at all this videotaped evidence, you see a person who, at the Greyhound bus station, sits with Mr. Cox for 2 hours, makes a bracelet, puts it on his wrist, slaps his head around, takes his hat off, puts it on her. It would tend to show that even if that threat did occur, that was not her motivating factor in going, and that her movements are not restricted. There's video from Fort Worth Greyhound Station, an Abilene 7-Eleven attached to the Greyhound Station, the El Paso Greyhound Station, showing at times Mr. Cox and RC would be separate.
But what about the kidnapper who kidnaps a 3-year-old and takes them to the circus and they have the best day of their life? Is it any less a kidnapping?
I think you are dealing there with a completely different situation. That's why these fact situations are unique. You have to look at exactly what happened in that situation. How were the movements restricted? Did the person who took the three-year-old obviously has to physically take the three-year-old, put them in the car, hold their hand, walk them to the circus? Whereas you've watched these.
Okay, they're already at the circus, and the person just takes them to the arcade area. Is that not a kidnapping?
I can't say it is or it isn't. I think that we need to look at the facts more specifically and see what the entire record is. To generally say that would be a kidnapping and one other situation is not, I think, doesn't apply the statute and the law vigorously enough. And that's what Brooks tells us we have to do in a sufficiency review at this point. So without more information, it seems a lot worse just at first blush, taking the three-year-old to the arcade versus the 14-year-old who participates and willingly goes and sits with the Mr. Cox at the bus station, walks onto the bus station, Mr. Cox goes to the bathroom, the 14-year-old, who's certainly more capable than the 3-year-old of walking away at that point. The 14-year-old who packed a bag the night before to go with him.
I understand that if for practical purposes, the facts are different, but with regard to the law, is the application any different?
The application has to be different because every case is different. If we just had a blanket rule and said, if these general facts occur, then that's a kidnapping, then the law, I believe you could make some arguments, would be broad and vague. We have to be able to take our statutes, apply them to the facts.
Scott, your time's up, but I want you to talk about the sexual assault in Mexico.
Okay. As far as our position that the state of Texas lacks jurisdiction,
yes,
for the sexual assault, the jurisdiction statute's different than venue. Jurisdiction requires that something occur, an element or a result of the offense occur in Texas in order for Texas to have jurisdiction. All of the testimony from RC is that this sexual assault occurred outside of Texas in Juarez, Mexico. And so this, I think, is much more straightforward than the kidnapping argument. This is simply that sexual assault, if it occurred in Mexico, and we don't have jurisdiction of that under these facts. Venue would be different if a jury had found that RC had been abducted here in Tarrant County, then venue would be fine, even if the sexual assault occurred somewhere else, if the jury found that. But the sexual assault, if the state can prosecute that person in Mexico for that, then our jurisdiction statute is sort of null and void. It's sort of useless.
Saying the only way the sexual assault can stand is if the kidnapping stands? Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. Okay. I'm actually saying those are completely separate analysis. It's completely separate. Once they get into Mexico, there is an offense that every element in the indictment, every element occurred in Mexico. And that's the reason that we do not have jurisdiction. If the kidnapping is actually different than that, because the state could make an argument that RC was abducted in Tarrant County, and so if for some reason they wanted to, and I can't come up with this reason, the fact situation, but I want to say the kidnapping was continuing in Mexico, and so we're prosecuting Mr. Cox for kidnapping her in Mexico. It's just different. If you're dealing with a continuous type offense that's a kidnapping versus a sexual assault, which in this case, and that Juarez sexual assault, stands on its own.
So if it had been kidnapping for the purpose of committing sexual assault, then it wouldn't matter that the sexual assault was in Mexico.
Well, I think that is
the offense began.
That's essentially what they indicted him for in count one, was kidnapping. And so I think that goes to kidnapping. But it doesn't change the sexual assault.
Well, Isn't one of the definitions of kidnapping grabbing somebody for the purpose of sexual assault? Or
that's what aggravates it. Actual terminology is intent to commit sexually abuse them.
It's a different phrase. If that were the offense being prosecuted and the sexual assault occurred in Mexico, it would be subsumed in the kidnapping and prosecuted as part of the kidnapping, like burglary with intent to commit, or burglary and did commit sexual assault, right?
It's sort of like that, but I'm
what about with intent?
I'm almost positive it's a different language. It doesn't specifically say sexual assault. It says to abuse sexually.
Okay.
And so it's where one argument, if it did say to commit sexual assault, then I think you could argue there's a double jeopardy.
To abuse sexually.
But to abuse sexually is a different argument. It's the person's intent to abuse sexually. So a person could be convicted of kidnapping, an aggravated kidnapping, even if they didn't complete the sexual abuse, but if the jury believed they intended it. Whereas sexual assault is a completely separate offense. If sexual assault wasn't a separate offense, then again, I think it would be subsumed, and we'd be talking about a double jeopardy argument. But I don't think that's the case under these facts.
You know, if an offense begins in Texas and goes someplace else, or begins in Tarrant County and goes to some other county, if any part of the offense occurs in Tarrant County, then Tarrant County can swoop up the whole offense, doesn't have to piecemeal it.
That's venue.
But you're saying that the sexual assault, even though the aggravating factor included sexual abuse, since the sexual assault, all elements of the sexual assault occurred in Mexico, that's what deprives this court, or Texas courts, of jurisdiction.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
All right, thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Curl, and let's add another minute to Mr. Curl's argument time, should he need it, or should we need it?
May it please the court, my name is David Curl, and I'm here representing the state. I intend to primarily talk about the issue of whether RC was abducted from Tarrant County, because that'll resolve most of appellant's complaints. Appellant's argument seems to be that there wasn't restraint because he doesn't like the way the victim behaved. And there are two independent reasons why that's not even a legally tenable argument. And the first is as appellant concedes, the Penal Code Section 20.01(1)(b)(2) makes her consent immaterial. So she can't agree to this. She can't acquiesce to being moved. And the appellant says there aren't any cases like this. Well, on pages 12 through 17 of our brief, we cite lots of cases that are a lot like appellant wants to construe the record. Lots of cases where if you construe the record in the light most favorable to appellant, that is, where a victim went off with a person voluntarily, and the court said, go in, that's not a defense, that's restraint. If you have a person who can't consent and they go off with the defendant, they're being restrained. That's the quick case is a lot like what the construction of the record appellant makes, and we cite the DeWalt case and the Hines case and the Walker case. These are on pages 12 through 17 of our brief. So for those reasons, appellant just doesn't, I don't think he has an even viable argument, even theoretically. The second reason is that even if RC is treated as an adult, there's still plenty of evidence to support a jury determination that she was abducted in Tarrant County. Now, appellant seems to want to construe the word restrained as you sort of have to tie somebody up. And you have to move somebody. And appellant, he repeatedly moved and ordered this little girl around, if you construe the record in the light most favorable to the verdict. And I think that Justice Sotareth's discussion of the three-year-old child, it fully disposes of appellant's legal theory. If appellant says that it has to be objectionable to the child, well, then that three-year-old can't be restrained if she goes off to the circus.
I think we spent a long time saying consent's irrelevant. What is restraint?
Restraint is moving, ordering, hiding. He took this little girl. When he first met her, he told her not to speak to anybody. He walked her to a city bus. He told her to pretend like she was his little sister. He took her to a Greyhound bus. He took away her phone so that she couldn't call her parents.
All right, he's taking away a phone restraint.
The Ojeda case that we cite lists that as evidence of restraint, is in their list of...
Evidence of restraint.
Yes.
But that'll... Okay. Is that... other than evidence of a restraint, is that an element of restraint? Cutting off a person's ability to contact somebody else to tell them where they are. Cutting off... is that an element of restraint? Is that something we look at and say, yes, this is indicative of restraint?
It's
part of restraint? What is it?
It's evidence supporting a finding of restraint is the way I would characterize it.
Okay.
As appellant concedes, there's evidence that RC's family was threatened by appellant. She testified she was afraid of him. She testified that he was mean when he was mad and that he was always mad. So all of that evidence... is plenty of evidence that she was moved around. He restricted her movement. There are cases where driving somebody in a car is restriction of their movement, and certainly walking them to a bus and putting them on a Greyhound ought to be as well. And getting back to the idea about the child's behavior, on page 19 of our brief, we cite Ojeda and Clark that talk about this idea that the child didn't, or the victim didn't behave right. It's not really evidence that an appellate court should get into, because you can't really decide how a victim is supposed to behave in response to a kidnapping. I mean, she said she was afraid. Well, maybe she decided to go along with him because she was afraid of him. And you don't insist that victims be heroes in order to sustain a finding of restraint. Just briefly, I wanted to mention, I didn't put this in our brief, but we do cite the DeWalt case in our brief, and on the issue of venue, DeWalt is an Austin opinion, and they held that a finding of the evidence was insufficient on the element of venue is subject to a harmless error analysis.
Yeah, but you're talking jurisdiction, not venue. That's different.
No, we're talking venue. On his fourth and fifth points, he's making venue claims about the aggravated sexual assault and the Texas sexual assault. I mean, the aggravated kidnapping and the Texas sexual assault. And we've argued that
there's no jurisdiction over a crime committed in Mexico.
That's a different point of error.
Okay.
Gotcha. I'm talking, but there was the aggravated sexual assault and the Texas the aggravated kidnapping and the Texas sexual assault are venue issues.
Gotcha.
And we've pointed out in our brief that if you find there was restraint in Texas or in Tarrant County, then these issues are immediately disposed of. But I did note that recently that the DeWalt case says that 44-2B analysis should apply even when there's a finding of insufficient evidence of venue, and we would just alert the court to that. I'll just briefly comment about the Mexico sexual assault. Our argument is under Penal Code 104A4 that if you do a preparatory act that assists a crime in Mexico, that you can be held criminally responsible in Texas. And we cited a case out of Utah called State versus Green, where facts a lot like this happened. If you take a little girl to Mexico so that you can live with her as your lover, then you should be allowed to be prosecuted in Texas for that sexual assault. Unless there are any questions, Allison.
Don't go anywhere. Okay, your position is that the jury wasn't entitled to a jury charge on jurisdictional issues?
Yes, that's one of his complaints on the Mexican sexual assault, and there really isn't any Texas precedent on it, and our position is it's not authorized by the legislature, and that just because there's a fact element involved doesn't mean it's the jury issue. We don't let juries decide speedy trial issues, for example.
You let juries decide DWI priors. You always offer evidence of the prior DWI unless they concede.
But that
goes to a jury.
That's an element of the offense. This is not an element of the offense.
Well, it's jurisdictional element of the offense.
A speedy trial claim is essentially
location in Texas is jurisdictional. that the offense occurred in Texas is jurisdictional.
Right. Well, we don't generally let juries decide jurisdictional issues.
You do in a DWI and in theft cases when you've alleged, when you're wrapping up a theft case.
But those are elements of the offense, not straight jurisdictional issues.
They've become elements of the offense because they're jurisdictional. That's why you get to offer evidence of it. At least that's what the case law says. You get to offer evidence of the priors to prove that the court is vested with jurisdiction to try the case, and the jury has to. That's why you get to offer it to the jury at guilt, not at punishment.
Well, I guess I'm a little confused about it, but I believe that that's just an element of the offense. But be that as it may, we just don't believe that this is an issue that the jury should be allowed to decide unless the legislature wants them to decide it, and they haven't said that. That's all I can think to say about that. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curl. Mr. Brown, rebuttal.
I want to touch briefly on several of the cases that Mr. Curl cites in his brief and why they are distinguishable from this fact situation. The DeWalt case was a 5-year-old child. It was a husband and wife got divorced. There was a custody order, and then later there was a new hearing. Someone filed a motion to modify. And at the conclusion of that motion to modify, the court ordered sole custody to the father. And at the time, the mother, there's some evidence in that case, it's a lengthy opinion with lots of detail about the record. The mother had obviously been planning already to take her 5-year-old to Mexico. She'd made some plans to do that. And she did, in fact, do that with the assistance of some family members and friends. And the distinguishing characteristics of that, number one, it's factually different. It's a 5-year-old. The mother's driving him in a car. But more importantly, probably, the points of error, sufficiency was not raised. The points of error were exclusion of evidence. The wife, the criminal trial, wanted to bring evidence of the father allegedly sexually and physically abusing the child. The court pointed out they were dealing with her motive versus her intent. She was trying to show evidence of motive, and that wasn't really relevant. It was just, did she intend to kidnap the boy, to abduct him, to restrain him? And so that's a totally different fact situation. Walker was a case that was not published out of Corpus Christi, dealing with an 11-year-old mentally handicapped child. This is a pretty kind of a spare or sparse opinion, because we don't get a lot of details about the testimony at trial, but it's clear that the defendant in that case did take the boy physically to a shed, and so you could see that there was restraint. He restricted his movement. The Hines case is very different. It's a bank robbery case where the teller was coming to work that morning, and the defendant came up to her and pointed a gun at her and moved her inside the bank. And there were some other facts where she was able to get away and they grabbed another teller. But essentially, those were the facts of that case. And so they're very different than our case. Again, trying to look at all these cases and come up with one rule that can apply to all is difficult. And so that's why each case has to be unique. And it's hard to do, but the exercise must be to focus on restraint and not consent. And when you do that, it's our position that this evidence is insufficient on the aggravated kidnapping in count one, and appellant's conviction sentence should be reversed. Thank you.
Mr. Brown, Mr. Curl, thank you for your arguments today, as well as your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused, and we will adjourn court, please.
All right. Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.